Hello and welcome to this lonely pod-only edition of the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy. This month's edition of the Culture File debate is also happening this week, in which we gather a panel of conductors to talk about how they can possibly go on in a post-COVID world. And you can find that in the very feed you found this. But hang on a minute, because right here, we're going to hear how the figure of the conductor emerged in the first place with music historian Peter Holman. And we'll have Jansey sounds from Kinshasa, and right at the end, Maurice Gohan will tell us why she's not too pushed about using her single transferable vote. But first, back to the conductor, how the figure emerged in the history of music, and what its future might be in the transformed world of post-COVID music. On Friday, we'll be talking to some of those currently working out the sounds of social distance in the Culture File debate, more of which anon. But before that, we're going to look back to a time in which seating arrangements at concerts took yet another form. The title of Peter Holman's latest book, Before the Baton, refers to an era in musical history before groups of musicians were controlled by a thin white stick or even a rolled-up sheet of paper held by one revered maestro or another, before the conductor. Peter Holman talked to Áine Gallagher about the conductor's origin story.
I'm slightly unusual, I suppose, in that I'm both an academic, I'm a retired professor at the University of Leeds. I'm also a performer, particularly directing early music groups of all sorts and playing in them, playing keyboard. And I suppose about 10 years ago, became increasingly dissatisfied with the way that we direct early music groups using modern conducting technique. And at the same time, I was becoming interested in the historical evidence for how it was done in the 17th and 18th centuries. So that's really what led to the book. It's interesting that modern baton conducting, in a way I define that by, it's not just the thin white stick which gradually came in the 19th century, but it's also the idea that you can affect an interpretation in performance. You're not just beating time as people earlier on did, you're not just keeping the ensemble together. You're actually imposing an interpretation on the music in the performance, and it affects dynamics and balance and all the things you see modern conductors doing. That actually happened in France in the late 18th century and spread to Germany and came to England in 1830s. Actually, it was by a Frenchman, a man called Chélard, who was directing a German opera group who came to London in 1832, and he was an inspiration to the English musical directors around at the time. Also, Mendelssohn was a very important influence too. He came to England again in the 1820s and was very influential in changing the concept towards modern baton conducting. Although he himself, I think, wouldn't have been thought of as a modern conductor. In fact, Wagner called him a mere Kapellmeister, i.e. someone who beat time.
One of the subjects that you cover in the book is that what we know of the conductor to be today has moved from being within the ensemble to outside the ensemble in different positions all over the place from as soon as notated music began. So it's an interesting thing about the position of the conductor.
That's right. I think Handel is a very good example. He's the central figure in the book, really, both in opera and in oratorio. With opera, it's quite clear that he preferred to play the harpsichord rather than conduct. In fact, no one directing Italian opera in the 18th century ever waved their arms around as they play. The important thing was to lead from the continuo instrument, from the harpsichord, which was, of course, the continuo in Baroque opera being the most important element of the instrumental. And Handel would have been placed not in the middle of the pit, but right at the side, where he was right against the stage and had good communication with the singers, but wouldn't have been in a position to direct the orchestra in the modern way. So, I mean, that was easy to establish because it was the universal Italian practice throughout the 18th century. And went actually even into the 19th century. The people were still directing either from the violin, that was a later model actually, directing from the violin in the late 18th century in the pit. But even in Verdi, the people were still not conducting in the modern way.
Thank you.
when Handel started producing oratorios in England, this was a rather new idea, and so he had to work out a method of directing it. He tried out various things, including beating time, which was what happened in large-scale church music. He would have beaten time with a roll of paper. That was the standard 18th century model in things like the coronation anthems. Or should he play the harpsichord as in opera, or should he beat time? And eventually he devised a system where he was able to direct from the keyboard. I spent quite a long time trying to work out exactly how he did this, and he had a harpsichord connected to an organ, and he, in the choruses of the oratorios, he played the organ part of it, and in the arias and recitatives, he played the harpsichord.
Now, these spaces that he would have been using would have been different to the modern day spaces that early music ensembles use. We wouldn't have seen the sunken theatre as you do today.
Well, no, in opera, no, they didn't have sunken pit. That's something we have to thank Wagner for, is the sunken pit. The whole idea of the sunken pit is that the conductor is the only person who can see the stage. Whereas in 18th century opera, it was essential that all the orchestra could see the stage and interact with the performers, and particularly the continuo players. I mean, I've spent many years of playing in opera groups and trying to get myself into a position where I could actually see the stage easily. And you often have to put the harpsichord up onto blocks and things to try and get rid of these wretched sunken pits to actually. Because I think 18th century opera depends on the interaction between the instrumentalists and the singers. Without the conductor.
Which is a very basic and simple visual to describe one of the ideas which you talk about throughout the book of collective interpretation, which is to an orchestral musician, kind of an unusual idea, but when playing early music makes a lot more sense because of the actual musical style.
Well, I suppose quite a good analogy would be with modern popular music and jazz, that on the whole, even quite large jazz bands, for instance, don't perform with a conductor. They just listen to each other and produce a collective interpretation. I think this is, the important thing, is that everyone in the ensemble is contributing to a performance with shared stylistic norms, whereas the mainstream today is to have a conductor who imposes his interpretation on the music. So it's therefore becomes the expression of a single person rather than a collective. With early music, we need to get back to this collective idea. And stars, sun and
stars. What was the desire for this move to the single conductor and to one person's interpretation?
I think it was all sorts of things. I think it was partly larger ensembles, larger choirs, larger orchestras, larger buildings. It was the expectations of critics and audiences who wanted something much more uniformed and disciplined. And I think that, yes, I mean, modern type conducting certainly improves the precision and the discipline of ensembles. And again, we might think about jazz in that respect, that a jazz band don't bother to start and finish exactly together necessarily, but they play superbly well together. So I think in a way, performances in the past in mainstream music must have been much more like jazz is today. And I think it was more spontaneity, less sort of machine precision. And I think the drive towards precision was something that of course, it goes hand in hand with the machine age, the 19th century, mass production, machines, precision, you know, it's all part of that. I mean, it's changing culture. It had to happen, I suppose, but I regret it, and I certainly think it's inappropriate for early music, or at least I think if people are going to conduct early music, I think that they need to be aware of what they're doing. So my whole book was really just to try to show people what happened in the past and to make them think about what they're doing today. Rolls of paper actually come in the middle of the 17th century. Before that, it's people just using hand gestures. So the roll of paper is a method of amplifying hand gestures. If you have music for several choirs, you have someone standing next to the organ beating time. And I should say, by the way, that beating time was just up and down. They didn't use sideways movements really until the late 18th century. And that has interesting implications for how the music would have sounded, because I think just up and down tends to give a lighter think, than people subdividing the beat. And if you see a performance where, for instance, something in compound time is subdivided, that's by definition wrong. I think this would never have happened in the 17th and 18th century. Even beating in 4-4, you know, with sideways movements, that didn't happen in the 18th century. Well, certainly didn't happen in the 17th century. Just up and down, the hand up and down, 1, 2, 3, 4, or in triple time, 1, 2, 3, up and down, 1, 2, 3, 1, you know. And that's still being, just up and down movements are still being recommended around 1800 in England, for instance.
So with this roll of paper, which was a symbol of authority, it has been slimlined into the baton, which is still a great symbol of authority. Along with the arrival of these implements, was the authority always becoming greater?
Yes. I don't think it changed. It changed very much throughout the 18th century. It began to accelerate right at the end of the 18th century into the early 19th century. But people were still directing from the keyboard in the early 19th century. Rossini, for instance, directed from the piano. So did Weber. I would say that certainly up to Bach and Handel, large-scale works, you know, Handel's Messiah, the Passions of Bach, they're much better directed from the keyboard, really. I've spent a lot of time directing these works from the keyboard, using a minimum of direction. Yes, I've been, okay, I have mostly an amateur choir I'm working with, so I do tend to conduct the choruses, to beat time in the choruses. If I had a completely professional group, I probably wouldn't have to do that. I would just play all the way through, as doubtless Bach and Handel did. Composers in the 18th century devised their music so that it can be performed with the minimum of direction. It's very striking in Handel, for instance, how, say in Messiah, how groups of choruses can be performed at the same tempo. It's very striking how often Handel starts a chorus with just a chord in the continuo. And he presumably playing the keyboard, just nodded to the continuo players who were grouped around him, and they started off like that. So he didn't even have to have the leader to start it off. We have evidence in the 18th century, later performances of Handel, that in a choral work, something like Zadok the Priest, that the leader would have started off because it starts with an orchestral passage, and that is the way Handel did it as well. Handel's a good example because, by all accounts, there's a lot of descriptions of him rehearsing and performing, that he seems to have been unusual among his contemporaries in the amount of control he wanted to exert on performances of his music. And yet this was all done in rehearsal rather than in performance. He wasn't a modern maestro. He preferred to play rather than to wave his arms around. And this is partly because he was doubtless the greatest continuo player in England at the time and preferred to do what he did best, which is playing the continuo. You can look at the history of music and see it as a sort of gradually increase of control by the composer. Certainly until the middle of the 19th century, most composers were also directors of their own music. I mean, the profession of a separate conductor performing other people's music only gradually developed. Philip Hayes at Oxford was one of the first people to make more of a career directing other people's music, i.e. Handel, rather than his own music. But, I mean, gradually, composers wanted to more and more control over every aspect of the music. This perhaps comes to an inevitable conclusion with someone like Schoenberg, who every single note, as it were, indicates exactly how he wants to be performed. And then there's a reaction against that, isn't there? With someone like John Cage, where chance is allowed back in, and performer begins to regain something of the autonomy of early music. This is something that hasn't really been recognised enough when people have written about the history of conducting. Is at a certain point that there is a divorce between the composer and a separate interpreter.
Peter Holman there on the rise of the conductor and indeed the composer. Peter Holman's latest book is called Before the Baton and is out now from Boydell and Brewer. Harp music next on the Culture File Weekly from Kinshasa. Sowa Sowa is a Ugandan composer and musician who'd like you to get to know the Adungu and even the Janzi, the first being a traditional harp, the second a brand new invention he created to make travelling easier on Ugandan musicians. From his studio in Kinshasa, he gave Culture File's Louise McMahon an extremely socially distanced demo of his creation.
My name is Sowa Chidianga James, Jr., but most people know me as Sowa Sowa. And I'm from Uganda, Kampala. This is the Janzi, an instrument I designed. Probably the first patented instrument from Uganda. Well, the word Janzi comes from a Janzi, which is a Chiganda word. I come from Buganda. Buganda as the dominant tribe in Uganda. So a Janzi is a grasshopper or a locust that flies. Janzi is a 22-string instrument. I play tuned in the diatonic scale and pentatonic scale. It has two sides. The diatonic, which sounds like, so those are 11 strings on my left. If I'm playing, let's say one chord, I use the three fingers. And that happens going down as that's my 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That's how it sounds like. And I have the pentatonic on my right, which we normally use with our Ugandan instruments, which sounds like. On my left, I normally use the three fingers. On my right, I use the two, but I can use the three as well. Yeah.
Okay, so you're using your thumb and your index finger.
Yes.
And then on the other side, you're using?
I use my thumb, the index, and
and the middle finger.
Yeah, that's what I use. So what I do is I play chords mostly on my left. And I do the improvisation on my right, which would sound like. But with the Adungu, if you Google the Adungu that has is into the same shape, it's only one side. But on this one, it's when I have to improvise, my notes are a bit more than what you would play, and the movements are more flexible. In 2014, I was at Copenhagen Airport, and I remember we were flying to Switzerland, and we had trouble having this Adungu. Making the Adungu, we use wooden pegs or nails. So this Adungu had nails. Which nails were considered a threat, and we were stopped. We had to explain. They said, no, we can have it. We'll give it to you when we land, which was okay for me. It was embarrassing. It was very embarrassing because this is an instrument that carries so much value to me from home and bring it to the world. But at the same time, I had to accept reality that this instrument is actually a threat. I thought, okay, maybe this is going to happen tomorrow someday, that someone else or not me is going to be stopped and asked questions because of the kind of material that is used. So one morning, I woke up. I had an Adungu myself that was broken. The neck was broken, and I wanted to fix it. So I called the carpenter and asked him, can you find a neck to replace this that is broken? He said, yeah. So he goes to pick a tape measure. But when he came back, I told him, I don't think I want to fix the Adungu. I'm actually going to create, or I'm going to build a new Adungu, which I did with him and amplified it, tried everything. And I called him, I told him, come, let's check out what we've made. And from that point, I thought, okay, if I can develop this into a beautiful Adungu, I think I can build something. The world knows a lot about West Africa, but the world does not know so much about where I come from, Uganda, East Africa, in terms of music. I was challenged when I met a gentleman in a music store in Germany who asked me what I was doing there, and I said, I'm a musician. And he asked me, what do you play? I said, instruments like the Adungu. He said, what's that? He said, I told him, it's a Ugandan harp. He said, oh, you mean the kora? I said, no, it's a hatched harp from Uganda. So we had to Google for him to see. And he said, no, I don't know that, but I know the kora. So in my understanding, I thought, okay, it is my responsibility to make sure that we get to know about the Adungu and now the Janzi, that all these instruments fall into the harp family. Recording the album, it was more about dancing, but also I was focusing on introducing some of the sounds from Uganda. The Janzi, I am the one that plays it alone, but it doesn't really make much sense that you made an instrument and you play it alone. You have to share with the world. She used to tell me I had this song while in the womb of my mama. Yeah. The melody was sweet and amazing. Made me kick while in the womb of my mama.
Sewa Sewa there on the Janzi, and his album Enva Kla, Grooves from Kampala, Uganda, is out on Arc Music. And finally on the Culture File Weekly, time for another audio epistle from writer and comedian Maurice Gohan. And this time Maurice has a political coming-of-age story, her own, warning this piece contains some unpalatable truths about representative democracy.
So we have our new government. Everybody besides Sinn Féin and Labour. Sinn Féin have to be secretly delighted. They were like the kid at school that promised they'd have the best rager parties if only their parents went away once in the school year. They'd have unlimited beer and fly in Robbie Williams to perform. Those kids knew their parents were homebodies. They never actually wanted to be held accountable to their wild ideas. I do think it's an absolute disgrace that the two biggest parties are going into government together. First off, the PUR system is a disgrace anyway. Oh, the third person I voted for gave his votes to someone else, and now that guy is elected? It's a farce. But having Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil in government together is putting a disgrace hat on a disgrace hat. Honestly, why are we bothering with illusion of democracy if the two biggest parties can go into government together? Putin wouldn't even pull something like this. I have a coloured history with Irish politics. I grew up in a Fianna Fáil family. And by that I mean my parents just voted for Fianna Fáil, not that I was a third Ahern daughter. My mother always made a point to teach me about politics as a kid, so I was a big fan of the TDs. During the 2012 election, I got my friends to tear down a poster of Tom Kidd, and I then hid the poster in my garden, and every day I would take it out and kiss Tom. A big smacker right in his plastic lips. Loved him. Forget Boyzone or Westlife, the Cabinet were my teenage crush. I grew out of Fianna Fáil when I got to college though, and I dabbled with Fine Gael. I became the event officer for Young Fine Gael in my final year at DCU. No event was organised the year I was at the helm, but that's just pedantics. I leaflet dropped for Leo back when he was just a TD. So I've had my finger in a few political pies in my life. But now, I don't vote. Yes, I said it. I do not vote. I know, people died for our right. I didn't know any of those people personally, but I do respect them. Me not voting isn't a slap in the faces of our ancestors. I don't vote because my vote doesn't matter. And that's the truth. Unless my vote is the deciding one, unless my party is going to lose by exactly one vote, or my one vote would cause them to win, only in that very unlikely scenario is my vote worth something. That might sound like hogwash, but there's an actual equation to this. I studied game theory. Game theory has nothing to do with PlayStation, but it's the maths behind why we make decisions. Like in the film A Beautiful Mind. People don't realise this about me because of my stunning good looks and the fact I say like a lot, but I'm very good at maths. 7 by 8, 56. I didn't even have to pause to think. I'm that good. So I don't vote, because my vote doesn't matter unless there was the deciding vote. And that's so low of a possibility, it's basically zero. So anything else I can do with my time instead of voting is more beneficial to me. And look, people always make the argument, but if everyone thought that. But here's the thing, everyone doesn't. We don't make decisions based on worst case scenarios. We make rough probabilities in our heads of the likelihood of something happening, and we make our choices based on that. We don't stop flying because a terrorist attack might happen, although Americans did do that for the year after 9/11 because their fear made them miscalculate the probability of it happening again. And in that following year, more people died from road accidents than they did in 9/11. We don't stop swimming in the sea, even though a shark could kill us all. We don't stop watching Dancing with the Stars, even though it's terrible TV. Okay, the last one isn't about probabilities. Although the probability that Dancing with the Stars is terrible is 100%. My point is that we make choices based on rough probabilities. I choose not to vote because I know everyone else will. I know my singular vote doesn't matter. I have the maths to back me up. 6 by 9, 54. Didn't even blink. I understand some people will think I'm ignorant for saying all this, and I get it. I'm letting my main man Tom Kitt down. But if you want me to vote, you need to give me a proper incentive. Free ice cream after you cast your vote. Set up an ice cream van, with flakes, let's not skimp, and have that creamy swirls of ice cream ready for each voter leaving the booth. Then I'd be there, voting for someone who will pass their votes on to someone else, who will then pass theirs on again, and then that other guy will be elected. Ah, democracy. I'll raise a 99 to that.
Marie Scohan there on the political economy of ice cream, bringing to a close this podcast-only edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more sweet and icy inducements next Friday, or whenever, wherever you grab your pod. During the meanwhile, don't forget to check out the Culture File debate, which too should be available where you get your podcasts. Until next time, bye now.